This is Bristol Band Beyond for Friday, February 5th. I'm Dave Benier, glad to have you tuned in. Coming up this week, reaction to Governor Walker's list of nominees for the Board of Fish, which did not include anyone from Bristol Bay.
I've never talked that strongly to a governor in my life, and I let him know how displeased we are. He didn't call Senator Hoffman, he didn't call Bryce Edgeman, he didn't call anybody in Bristol Bay.
On social media this week, there was a lot of discussion on how criminal cases are prosecuted, including the common method of temporarily reducing felony charges to misdemeanors. Defense attorney Chris Lesh joins to explain why that happens.
You cannot be held in jail for more than 10 days on a felony complaint unless your case is taken to the grand jury.
Plus, police officers in Dillingham are now all equipped with body cameras. Youth are out trapping fur-bearing animals, and Winterfest has its queen.
I knew I had been nominated, but I did not know that I had been selected, so it was a surprise.
Those stories are coming up after a look back at some of the week's news. Tragedy struck in Togiak Saturday when a boat carrying three men and three moose capsized in the bay near the village. James Toots, Eric Kupchayak, and Larry Arnariak were killed, and all three men's bodies were recovered by the following morning. Daryl Thompson says the weather was not good Saturday evening as the men were trying to get home.
The wind was 40 to 60 miles an hour, probably. Waves are pretty high, and it was dark, and there's ice, and they're right inside the side of the village. I mean, it's just not too far away, but waves swamped, and then they're in the water.
None of the men were wearing life jackets. Elder Pete Abraham says he was frustrated by what might have been a preventable tragedy.
We need more elders to talk to the young generation about boating, sledding, whatever, snow machining. Not enough people, young people, to listen to these things here. But we need more. We need more encouragement to talk to the young generation about being cautious out there.
The community is gathering today for the funeral services for Toots, Kupchayak, and Arnariak. On Tuesday came word from the governor's office that a Bristol Bay resident would not be nominated for a seat on the Board of Fish. Fritz Johnson of Dillingham was dropped, and in his place, Walker put Robert Ruffner from Soldotna up for another chance. Speaking Tuesday before the dust had settled, Walker said he felt it was time for a change.
I just wanted a little different balance, not necessarily of user groups, but a regional balance. Certainly wouldn't look at this as a trend in any way, but I think that there's a lot of angst in the Cook Inlet Peninsula region, and the individual both were quite obviously quite good. Fritz is very good. He's been a good board member, and I look at Robert Ruffner, and I look at his. I think what he brings to the board, and I just felt I needed to have a little bit of a shift.
Some are saying Ruffner may not be entirely sold on the idea of standing for the seat again this session. The other two nominees are Alan Kane of Anchorage and Israel Payton of Wasilla. Department of Education Commissioner Mike Hanley has been asked to step down from his post. Governor Walker asked for Hanley's resignation effective March 1st. After 5 years heading the department, Hanley says now isn't the time he would have chosen for a leadership change.
Transitions are always hard, but we're in the middle of a session. We've got new federal law. We've got moving towards a new assessment. So, but I surely respect the governor and the board chair for wanting to make changes, and I can surely honor that.
Dr. Susan McCauley will take over as interim director in March. The Dillingham School Board this week heard a complaint brought by the local teachers' union over the issue of plane tickets bought by the district in 2014 for certain new hires.
That constitutes a wage, and as a wage, it should be negotiated through us, and that he can't just offer that outside of a negotiation with the union.
Local union leader Eric Light speaking there. The school board rejected the grievance Monday on the grounds that it was not timely. The Dillingham Education Association is now considering whether to take its case to arbitration or to drop it. Last night, many Alaskans made clear they do not want to see large cuts to their annual permanent fund dividends. That was the message heard loudly about Governor Bill Walker's plan during public testimony to the Senate State Affairs Committee. Deering resident Kevin Moto said local businesses allow residents to make payments based on future dividends.
In rural Alaska, the dividend contributes to the economy. And I think by reducing the distributions, we're creating a bigger rural-urban divide.
Walker has proposed using permanent fund earnings to pay for about $3.3 billion worth of the state's spending. And finally, Alaska Attorney General Craig Richards says the state wants authority to pursue charges against former VECO boss Bill Allen for allegedly transporting a young woman across state lines for sex. In a letter to U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch today, Richard says a new law requires that she cross-designate the state to pursue the federal case or else provide a detailed explanation why she won't. Allen, once a powerful Alaska businessman and political mogul, was the key witness against Senator Ted Stevens. Defenders of the late senator allege Allen lied on the stand to avoid charges he had paid sex with a woman whom he flew to Alaska for that purpose. Allen faces similar allegations in a civil lawsuit from a woman seeking monetary damages. More on this week's news can be found at our website, kdlg.org. You're listening to Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. It came as something of a bitter surprise Tuesday morning when Governor Bill Walker's nominees for the Fish Board did not include a name from Bristol Bay. While there's nothing written to say the board should or must have a representative from the region with the world's largest sockeye fishery, etc., it has been customary since the 70s. Rather than put Dillingham's Fritz Johnson up for another term or substitute another person from the Bay, Walker put Robert Ruffner of Soldotna up for another go at confirmation. He fell just shy of the necessary votes last session, and rumors are that Ruffner is not entirely committed to the idea of going through that legislative gauntlet again. But for now, Bristol Bay is off the list. Robin Samuelson happened to be on his way to Juneau that morning and was all over the news by that afternoon, not mincing his words about how he felt. Well, he got back to Dillingham last night and stopped by this morning to offer more perspective. Robin, good to see you back in town, and thanks for joining.
Yes, thank you.
Ouch.
Yeah, it was a big ouch. The Board of Fish appointment that left Bristol Bay went to the Kenai River, and I went down and spoke with the governor. Had some real frank discussions with the governor on removing the our transfer in the Bristol Bay seat from here to the Kenai River, and explained to him our dissatisfaction with the process that took place. And in the end, I think the governor will consider putting a Bristol Bay person on. We have to put the pressure on the governor, but I think that we will again see a seat for Bristol Bay.
You were down there for one long day. Do you think that some of that pressure was generated in the halls of the state capitol there?
Oh, absolutely. I've talked to senators, representatives from other districts that were very dismayed by the process that unfolded.
We know that all these confirmations end up being contentious. Do you think Mr. Ruffner's confirmation process, if he chooses to stay in the ring for this, will prove contentious? The governor said he thought he could get him through this time.
Well, you know, I don't know who the governor's talking to. The people I talked to down there, and I wasn't advocating against the individual. I was talking about the process and the removal of the Bristol Bay seat. But there's a lot of folks that voted for him last time that told me they're not voting for him this time. And because of the process, how he was selected, they felt was very wrong.
Why is it so important to have a seat on the board? Bristol Bay has always had that seat. It's not guaranteed, but it's been, what, in your mind? Why is it important, and why do we get it?
Well, since the days of Herman Schroeder, we've had a seat. We've got 2,800 permit holders in Bristol Bay. We have the largest salmon fishery in the world. We have the largest herring fishery in Alaska. We have the largest fishery right off our front doorsteps out here. We have Bristol Bay crab, the number one delicate, sought-after crab within our waters of Bristol Bay. And our sport fishery is probably the number one or number two in the state of Alaska in Bristol Bay. Subsistence is paramount in Bristol Bay, not only Bristol Bay, but the Kuskokwim, Yukon, and Norton Sound, as well as to the people down on the Alaska Peninsula. And you got to have that diversity on that board. Right now, the three seats that the governor, the three nominees the governor nominated are all from urban Alaska cities. They don't know nothing about subsistence and how important it is, or commercial fishing.
If the governor makes any changes or if any of these nominees fail, what names may be submitted? Do you have any names that may come out of Bristol Bay?
No, this all This all happened day before yesterday. I mean, it came out of nowhere. It came out of the third floor, you know.
It seems like Governor Walker had enjoyed much support from rural Alaska and from Bristol Bay kind of until recently, and some of that seems to erode. You had several meetings with him the other day. What was your sense? Is he aware that he might be?
You know, we have this disagreement. I think Bristol Bay still supports Governor Walker and Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott, and we'll work with him to try to rectify the situation. I think that the governor, the third floor, he might have got bad advice. I don't know. For whatever reason, he wouldn't explain to me why he did what he did. But I think that the governor realizes the situation. I sure voiced it real strong to him.
Care to share any of those choice words here?
I think they may be bleeped out. So, but I took my hat off. I mean, I've never talked that strongly to a governor in my life. And I let him know how displeased we are. He didn't call Senator Hoffman. He didn't call Bryce Edgman. He didn't call anybody in Bristol Bay. And I brought that up. I said, you know, Governor, it isn't that hard to call us to tell us what you're thinking of doing or what you're going to do, and especially on this important issue. I mean, right now, our price of salmon is 50 cents a pound. Our people are rocking and reeling out here. He's talking about taking half of the permanent fund. Some of that permanent fund dollars is 50% of a household income in Bristol Bay. Them are major dollars. These budget cuts that they're talking about is going to have a real negative effect on rural Alaskans, probably more so than the urban folks, you know. And they just don't hear enough from rural people. And, boy, I really felt like my back was against the wall. And I wish I had 20 more people from rural Alaska with me when I was down there. But, you know, I think of my dad, and I think of Eddie Hoffman, and I think of Joe Clark and those leaders that taught me. And they were with me. I thought of them while I was down there. And, you know, we are going to make a difference on this Board of Fish seat. We will get a Bristol Bay seat back.
Do you think that could change this year, or do you think that will change with the two nominees that will be up again next year?
Well, if his three nominees go for confirmation before the legislature and they don't get confirmed like Ruffner did last year, he lost by one or two votes, and if he doesn't get confirmed, I would urge the governor and lieutenant governor to replace that person with a Bristol Bay person.
I guess we'll wait and see what happens here. Could be days, could be a couple of weeks, but glad to have your perspective on it.
Well, as Paul Harvey says, stay tuned for the rest of the story.
Robin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Last night, the Winterfest in the Bristol Bay Borough crowned this year's queen. This morning, we spoke with Heidi Steinberg, who is the principal of the Bristol Bay Christian Learning Center, and she tells us the honor came as a bit of a surprise.
Well, yes, I knew I had been nominated, but I did not know that I had been selected, so it was a surprise.
Steinberg was nominated by a former student who talked about her support of the community, her and her husband's weekly ministry in South Naknek, mentioning also her work at the school and as a longtime piano teacher. While Miss America has an important role as a spokesperson of millions of Americans on certain issues like, say, world peace, Steinberg says she'll use her platform as Winterfest Queen too, but maybe scale back the message a bit.
More of a message of community, staying together, working together, enjoying our life here in Bristol Bay. So it's more of that.
Her first job as queen was to draw a raffle name for the early bird contest last night. Beyond that, she says she'll make appearances throughout the rest of the weekend, donning the Winterfest Queen's honorary sash and unique crown.
Oh, as much as I can, and if it's too hot, I can take it off. It is a fur hat, and we aren't having 20 below, so I'll pop in on different Winterfest events as I can.
Events over in the Bristol Bay Borough continue through Sunday. This is Bristol Bay and Beyond. Back in a moment. Such a good time, I'm having a ball. Don't stop me now. If you wanna have a good time. This week there was some confusion about the felony drug charges against Joshua Rivera, an out-of-towner who was caught selling heroin out of a Nerka Loop residence a few weeks ago by Dillingham police. His case is still open, and the prosecutor tells us she intends to take it to the grand jury for an indictment. That doesn't mean all the drug charges stick. We also learned this week that a charge of selling a dose of heroin to a police informant against Nicholas Tinker of Aleknagik was dismissed. We'll have more on that case and others next week in our local news. But back to Rivera, which has caused much angst on social media. The charge against him was reduced from a felony to a misdemeanor. The reasons that happens is sometimes Bush law cases, criminal cases, can't be brought to a grand jury for an indictment inside of 10 days. The misdemeanor is a bit of a placeholder to buy the state a little more time. The process is called Kamaroff Notice, named for a 2007 case out of the Bethel Court. My next guest is Christopher Lesh, an attorney with the Public Defender's Agency based in Dillingham, who was here speaking as a criminal defense attorney and not on behalf of the agency. Lesh says Kamaroff can be problematic.
I think it's used incorrectly. There's no notice requirement. What Kamaroff says is that an individual cannot avoid a felony charge by pleading to a lesser charge in order to avoid indictment, basically. So what happens out here a lot is people get what's called Kamaroff notices after usually 10 days of them being charged with a felony. The charges are reduced to a lesser charge with a Kamaroff notice. And so what that case says is that they can't just plead to that lesser charge at that point to avoid a felony. And that's what the notice is. It's putting the defendant on notice that the state of Alaska intends to pursue the felony level charge.
So what the state is doing is dropping a felony charge to a similar but lesser misdemeanor version while they take their time to pursue an indictment at grand jury.
So yes. But
let's talk about the confusion that occurs when that happens.
Okay. Well, we started probably in the middle of the process, so I think we should start at the beginning. So when a person is arrested, the police see something, they usually write it down and record it, and they create a charging document, and that person is charged with a crime. Could be a misdemeanor violation or a felony misdemeanor violation if you're going in order from most serious to least serious. If you're charged with a felony in the state of Alaska, you cannot be held in jail for more than 10 days on a felony complaint unless your case is taken to the grand jury. So the state of Alaska simply has 10 days to bring the evidence they've accumulated to a grand jury to decide whether or not felony charges are warranted. And that's what a grand jury is. It's like a mini trial. It's not a high burden of proof like a criminal trial would be proof beyond a reasonable doubt, but it's whether or not there is enough proof to justify criminal charges. And it's a safeguard. What Kamaroff does from a defense attorney's perspective is it muddies the waters and it confuses a lot of people. It gives the state of Alaska and the district attorney's office more time to evaluate their cases. And what some of the negatives I see are that people who shouldn't be charged with any crimes at all are charged with these lesser crimes while the state of Alaska figures out witness problems, evidence problems, and stuff like that. And then from the community perspective, seeing some of the posts, it upsets them because they want these people charged immediately, but that's not unfortunately, how the law works, because it's tough for the state to get their evidence to a grand jury within that 10-day time window.
Let's use a hypothetical. Let's say somebody was charged with first-degree assault, and that was lowered to fourth-degree assault while the state does its job pursuing an indictment. The bail could be very different. Do your clients say, hey, if this is all I'm charged with, why can't I get out for $500?
They do, and the courts here are usually very understanding about that. But when we have this process, they know how the Kamaroff system works. That type of argument is usually more persuasive to the courts here after a little more time has passed. So making that argument at the 10-day window doesn't persuade the judge as much as a two-month window. It's a system that ticks off defendants because it keeps them in jail longer if they say they can't make bail. they never should have been charged in the first place. So it takes them a little bit longer for the state of Alaska. It alleviates them of a burden to figure out whether or not this is a case worth pursuing or not. And so the negative implications that I see are that people are kept in jail, kept in the process longer than they should have had the state maybe waited on the arrest decision, waited to consider all the evidence and have an attorney, a prosecutor, look at it and then make a determination that this case should go to grand jury. That should be done first. And then the person brought in, arraigned, you know, and bail set, and the process moves forward from there rather than this preliminary window, which causes a lot of confusion for everybody.
You're a lawyer and you're an Alaska resident. Stepping back from your role as a public defense attorney, can you see the state creating a solution to fix this? It seems like it could be a statute change with a couple of lines.
Well, I think there has been talk before. It may be a burden for the local communities, but I think the easiest fix is for the local leaders to start talking and asking about why the grand jury process isn't handled in the community, in the region. And that's the big hang up, because it's strange. Every individual has a right to a trial by their peers, and there's very good case law. When you live in Bush, Alaska, your jury has to reflect those community members, and that's fair. That's justice, right? So you have the type of makeup, Native Alaskans, people who've lived here for 20, 30 years, people who work in rural Alaska jobs and understand what life is like in Dillingham, Alaska. But you have a grand jury process where whether or not this is a crime occurred is decided by Anchorage residents. And I think anyone who's lived in Dillingham more than, a year would agree that Dillingham residents are very different and have different values and may see things a little bit differently than people who are living in Anchorage. And so I think the quickest fix would be to, a Bethel, I think Nome and Kotzebue, they all have local grand juries, and that makes the 10-day burden a lot easier to meet.
Chris Lesher is an attorney with a public defender's agency based in Dillingham. Chris, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to KDLG's Bristol Bay and Beyond. An investigative report this week concluded that Kodiak police officers responded professionally and appropriately when they pepper-sprayed an autistic man, Nick Pletnikoff, back in September. That incident caused an uproar over the fall, and again last month when Kodiak police released audio and video from the event. And it's one of a slew of recent encounters involving police force that have led many Americans to demand measures like equipping officers with body cameras. Some departments, including Dillingham's, have already begun to do so voluntarily. KDLG's Hannah Colton visited the Dillingham Police Department this week to check out how their brand new body cams are working out.
Like people 30 and under in workplaces everywhere, Officer Tanner Lowry is labeled the tech-savvy one by default.
Since I'm the younger one, so, technology is a little bit more, my thing, just because.
So when the Dillingham Police Department got a batch of 4 new wearable video cameras last month, it was Lowry they called on to help get them set up.
Turn on. It's just a flip of the switch, and it just takes like half a second to turn on, and then it vibrates, and then a little red light's on to indicate to me that it's on.
The 1.5 by 3 inch camera sits Velcroed on the center of Lowry's chest, sandwiched between a flashlight and a handheld radio. The camera is actually one of the smallest things he has strapped on his vest. And Lowry says the new cameras, at $250 a piece, are much better than the $80 models DPD was using when he got here 2 years ago.
They were smaller. They were difficult to understand if they were on or not. They had just had one blinking light. In the dark, it was just pitch black. You couldn't see anything. These ones come with a light, so you can actually see pretty well in the night with them. The camera quality is better.
Of course, Lowry says there are still limitations. Since the camera's on his chest and not, say, attached to a pair of glasses, it's not going to see what he's seeing if he turns his head. But Police Chief Dan Pasquarello says the cameras are a step up from the department's long-standing practice of audio recording.
We've always documented our interviews and our contacts with audio.
In his 20-plus years at the department, Pasquarello's seen the technology shift from microcassettes to digital audio recorders, and finally, a couple years ago, to digital video cameras.
We decided to get body cameras for the same reason a lot of police departments in America are going to body cameras, to visually document police activity and our interactions with the public. We wanted to reduce complaints, document evidence, and record videos of crime scenes.
Time magazine reported last month that of the 18,000 local and state police departments in the nation, nearly a third of them are in the process of putting body cameras on their officers. In big city police departments, like the LAPD, for example, the transition is expected to take millions of dollars and dozens of new staff to keep up with video storage. But for a small department like Dillingham's, it's an easy enough task. Each of the eight officers is responsible for offloading his own videos onto one big external hard drive at the end of each day. For Officer Lowry, the 20 minutes of extra work is well worth the peace of mind he gets with having proof of his behavior on the job.
It's actually really helpful when you're in situations and you have someone who's saying you did something bad that, you know, is not really right, and you're like, I didn't do that, and you have something to prove that you didn't do what they say you did.
The video clips stay in their neatly organized files indefinitely, or until they get handed over to the district attorney's office. Asked whether members of the public can request to see the videos, Pasquarello indicated that has not been the department's practice.
We just release the videos as discovery in criminal cases.
Four of DPD's officers have been getting used to the new cameras for a couple months now. The other four are slated for an upgrade this week. In Dillingham, I'm Hannah Coulton. So why are you acting like a bloody fool? If you get hot, then you must get cool. Bad boys, bad boys.
Finally, this week, we've been on the hunt lately for stories of what you're up to this winter, as most of us aren't skiing and riding and hunting as normally. Well, KDLG's Molly Dishner caught up with a group of young folks who have been learning the ins and outs of trapping, and she brought us this story.
The 4-H Trapping Club is part practical outdoor skills, part comedy club, part King of the Mountain. On a recent Thursday night, I tagged along as they pulled their traps. The group had eight traps set along a creek off Kanakanak. The sun was setting when we walked across frozen tundra to check them.
We'll just go by feel here. It's still set. If we were just checking, then okay, nothing in there. We'll cover the hole back up if we have snow.
That's Andy Aderman. He and Joe Stallmaster are the group's leaders. Aderman has been trapping since he was 5, younger than the crew he's been teaching this winter. Most of the traps are covered in ice, and it takes some chopping to get the metal device back out. We come across one that's a little bit easier.
I think we might have lucked out and not have much chopping to do here.
No chopping at all.
This is all?
Sure. Come on. Zach, you good?
All right, let me see.
Four, three, two. One, two, Zach, do it.
All right.
None of the traps have anything in them tonight, but sixth grader Noah Sage tells me what they've found on other outings.
A beaver, two otter, and mink.
When they're not chipping away at an icy creek, or playing King of the Beaver Lodge, as the case may be, the boys learn what to do with the animals they've caught in a garage off Lake Road. Noah tells me about the lesson at hand.
We are stretching our mink, and I think it's called fleshing too.
A couple weeks earlier, they skinned the minks, using a knife to separate the skin from the inside. Sixth grader Reese Bennis says that included the grossest part.
When we're cutting the mink, there's this part where the poop comes out, and it stinks. Most of the times, you'll accidentally cut it.
Now, Aderman explains how to use a hog scraper to clean off the skin.
So you got them inside out, got the feet pulled out. What we're trying to do is get rid of this little bit of fat. They're especially fatty down here on their
bottom,
on their belly. They also have what's called a saddle that's on their shoulders. This stuff, normally when you're doing these for the fur market where you're going to sell them, you leave that, you can trim a little bit of that. That fat and that thicker muscle off, and then they recommend you just leave the rest of it.
Once scraped, the furs are pinned to stretchers to dry out. Getting them ready, it's been a meticulous process and a little bit tedious.
You still got a lot to go.
And you still got a lot to go.
But in a room full of preteen boys, there's always something to laugh about.
Your mom's so stupid, she put 2 quarters in your ear and she thought she was listening to 50 Cent.
That one's old.
The boys know it takes a thick skin to be a Bristol Bay fur trapper. In Dillingham, I'm Molly Dishner.
That's it for this week's Bristol Bay and Beyond. You can find this and past episodes at our website, kdlg.org. Send your tips and ideas to news@kdlg.org. Before we go, the community of Togiak has had a difficult week since losing 3 men over the weekend. They're gathering today for the funerals of James Toots, Larry Arnariak, and Eric Kupchayak. I spoke with Jimmy Kupchayak just a bit ago for an update on the community.
I would like to start off by thanking everybody that's called, that came to be with family. And on behalf of the family, I'd like to say thank you to everybody. On behalf of the families.
I'm Dave Bittinger. We'll see you back here next week.